Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Sunday evening, and we're thinking theatrically and thinking musically here with someone who's responsible for some of the best musicals ever in the history of Broadway. And I do not say that at all lightly. And I'm not even going to do a long intro here because I want to spend more time talking to Sheldon Harnick than talking about him. So Sheldon Harnick, welcome to the Daverhood.
Thank you for those very kind words.
Well, I mean, come on, Fiorello and She Loves Me and, of course, Fiddler on the Roof, it wouldn't quite be the same history of musical theater without those shows.
I have to admit they are good shows.
even with modesty, what can you say about Fiddler on the Roof? There's no way to be immodest about it, and She Loves Me as well, and some of the other stuff. But let's get back to sort of the beginnings of how you got started doing that all, which was mainly through the review circuit, if I'm correct.
When I came to New York, that's true. There were still the reviews, and actually, when I went to Northwestern University, at which time I was planning to be a violinist, not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I was contributing songs to the annual student review there. And through that, I met a student who later had a career under the name Charlotte Ray. We became very good friends. She came to New York before I did. And when I came to New York, she asked me if I would write her a piece of material. And I did. And then she was tapped to go into New Faces, the Leonard Stillman's New Faces, and she was going to perform that song. It was called The Shape of Things. Then Abe Burrows saw her and pulled her out of the show, so she was not in that show. But by that time, I'd met the producer, Leonard Stillman, and he told me that they were replacing Charlotte with a wonderful performer named Alice Ghostly.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And he asked if I had anything for her, and I had started a song, which was called The Boston Begin. So I finished it, and Alice did that. That was my debut on Broadway in the New Faces of 1952. Alice had that song, and I must say she stopped the show with it every night.
Well, I'm kind of curious, how come, do you think, over the years, that whole genre of musical, especially on Broadway, kind of died out? We really don't get the review anymore unless it's a tribute to one particular composer or... we just don't really... What happened to it?
Well, what happened, I think, was television. Especially at the height of the reviews, suddenly there were all these television variety shows, Ed Sullivan and so forth, and they could get stars, and they could do topical material every week, Sid Caesar, whatever. They could do topical material, whereas with the review... If you prepared the material, it was maybe 6 months to a year before you could raise the money to get the show on. So by the time you got the show on, you were lucky if there were any topical lines in it at all. Also, the usual show could maybe feature one or two stars, maybe three if they were lucky, not nearly what you could do on television. So I think the review became kind of edged out by what you could do on television. What's ironic about that is that kind of show, the variety show, has more or less, I think, disappeared from television. But the review has not come back. What does come back are shows which are like reviews. They have a theme and that they have numbers which make it like a review. A show like Company, for instance,
in my opinion.
That's kind of like a review format.
That's already still within, feels more like a Broadway show, but I'm thinking the closest I would think is something like Secrets Every Smart Traveler Should Know, or thematic stuff like Pets,
yes,
where it's an entire show about pets.
And some of the stuff is still happens off-Broadway.
Yeah.
Some of it does.
So you went from doing particular songs for particular kinds of performers. At what point did you say, hey, maybe I'm going to take a shot at working on a full-length musical, kind of musical?
Well, first of all, I didn't really write songs for performers.
Well,
although
Charlotte Ray,
although I wrote a song for Charlotte, it was a song that could be done by anyone. And that's mostly the way I wrote. I had an idea for a song, and I worked on the song, and then found where I might use that song, but it wasn't necessarily written for a performer.
Okay.
At any rate, happily, my career began to take root as a very an accomplished, capable young writer. And the big break for me came when Jerry Bock had done Mr. Wonderful with a writer named Larry Holofcener. And I'm not sure what happened, but their relationship broke up. And so Jerry was looking for a new lyricist. His publisher, Tommy Volando, knew of my work, and he had me meet Jerry. We got along very well. And Tommy Volando accomplished the impossible. He managed to get producers who were looking for a songwriting team for a new musical. He managed to get those producers to hire Jerry Bock and myself to do that musical, even though we had never written a song together. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Wow.
And the show was called The Body Beautiful back in 1957, I think it was.
And how did it do?
It did not do well. I must say, I learned a big lesson. The company manager of the show, whose name I can't recall, there was a staff meeting, and mostly what I did was listen, because I was kind of the new kid on the block when it came to book musicals. But they were talking about possible directors. The director they wanted to use was a man named George Schaefer, who had done a lot of wonderful work on television, some work in the theater. The company manager said, "Don't use George Schaefer." And I'm thinking to myself, why? Is he an alcoholic or something? It turned out that that wasn't the case at all. What the company manager meant was, if you use a director, he should become involved with the show maybe 6 months before you go into rehearsal, so he can really study the script and ferret out all of the weak places and do whatever he can to improve those places before you go into rehearsal. George Schaefer, as it turned out, was so busy, he was so popular, that he could not join our show until about 2 weeks before we were to go into rehearsal. And that's why the company manager said, this is dangerous. But they chose to use George Schaefer anyway. So what we did, George came in more or less unprepared. We had our pre-Broadway tryout, and we worked as hard as we could, and we made a lot of improvements. But I've always felt that the show that we went out of town with, the pre-Broadway tryout, the show that we opened on Broadway with, that's the show that we should have taken out on our pre-Broadway tryout, so we could have improved it from there. It was never quite good enough, and we ran about 6 weeks. Ironically, that's the second time I've used that word. Joe Stein, who wrote the book for The Body Beautiful with at that time his collaborator was Will Glickman, Joe Stein was honored by the York Theater, the little York Theater in New York.
Sure.
They did, on successive weekends, they did four of his musicals in concert readings. And they had the season lined up, and then suddenly they lost one of those musicals. So they asked Joe if they could do The Body Beautiful. And Joe called Jerry Bock and me, and he said, they want to do The Body Musical. We burst out laughing. We said, but that was a big flop. He said, well, they want to do it. And we thought, well, okay. That won't hurt. The audience who comes to see it, they're going to know it was not successful. Well, they got the right director for it and the right cast for it, and it played wonderfully. It was about 50 years. I think this year it would be 50 years since it opened. We hadn't seen it in all that time, and it was such a wonderful surprise. The audience had a good time. We had a wonderful time.
Oh, great, yeah. Because, I mean, the York is doing the marvelous work when they do that, because the audience isn't going in there expecting a $15 million Broadway musical hit. They're anticipating some really good songs and a book, or parts that don't work, parts that do work, but ultimately a good time in the theater from what was still considered at that point the golden age
right.
of musical theater.
And they do a wonderful service by bringing to their audiences for five performances shows that maybe didn't succeed but have some element that's really worth seeing again. And that's a terrific thing for them to do.
So you ended up still working, obviously, with Joseph Stein. And, well, what happened after The Body Beautiful?
Well, The Body, I was ready to commit suicide after The Body Beautiful. I thought I had my big chance. I blew it. And I thought, okay, it's back to the industrial shows, which is how I made a living. But Harold Prince and his then-partner, Bobby Griffith, had seen The Body Beautiful. we met Jerry Bach and I met with them on opening night, and they told us that they really liked the score. They had problems with the show as a whole, but they liked the score. And they followed through on that because 1 year later, they were doing the show Fiorello. And at first, they were looking for... They didn't want a lyricist because they were approaching book writers, and they figured that the book writers themselves might want to do the lyrics. And that's what happened. Every book writer they approached said, well, yes, but I want to do book and lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
As it happens, they didn't care for any of the book writers. When they got to Jerome Wideman, he too said, I would like to do book and lyrics. They said, okay. So Jerry Bach was keeping me informed of what was going on. Wideman submitted some lyrics. And Wideman, of course, was a novelist. So that, as Jerry described it, he said the lyrics were like small novels. He said they were as long as Beowulf. And so what happened was that Al Prince and Bobby Griffith said, Mr. Wideman, we like the sample book scenes you wrote, but we don't think you're the right lyricist. And he said, fine.
Hmm.
So at that point, they set out to find a lyricist. And they went to four different teams and asked them to do songs on speculation. I don't remember who the other three teams were, but Jerry Bach and I were one of the teams. So we had to write four songs on speculation, and happily, when we played our songs, they said, okay, you're it. So we got the job, and Fiorello was successful, unlike The Body Beautiful, so suddenly I was, I hate this term, but I was a marketable commodity.
Well, yeah.
And so my career took off.
And let me ask, a song like Politics and Poker, so was that one of those that just... You were desperate, you needed a song.
No,
in
I think the
yeah.
only two songs, of the songs we wrote on spec, two of them wound up in the show. One of them was the waltz Till Tomorrow, and one of them was a strike number, which where Fiorello leads a strike of the garment workers. The other two songs were dismissed. Now, Politics and Poker was an example of how lyricists prey on book writers. Book writers write these wonderful scenes, and then lyric writers come to them and say, hey, I think I can put a song in there, but do you mind if I borrow your best joke? You know? So that's what happened with Politics and Poker. Jerome Wideman had written a wonderful card-playing scene, and I thought that should be a song. And I borrowed whatever I thought could be useful for the song, and we were both happy about it.
Yeah, whatever makes the show go.
Absolutely.
If it services the show, that's the main thing.
Absolutely. Hi, this is Sheldon Harnick, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on station WGBB.
After Fiorello, was Tenderloin next? Or did
Tenderloin was next.
Yeah.
And the mistake we made there was that Fiorello was such a euphoric experience that even before it had opened, while we were still, I think, previewing, Hal Prince and Bobby Griffith and Jerry Bach and I and George Abbott and Jerome Wideman all started to work on Tenderloin. And not enough time. It's almost like the story about George Schaefer. We didn't spend enough time worrying about what we were doing and where the traps might be. And consequently, because it was George Abbott, not George Schaefer, the show was better constructed. But when we opened out of town in New Haven, I remember we had a meeting after the show. We opened badly. Mm-hmm. And after the show, we went to the Taft Hotel to George Abbott's suite, and George Abbott, who was the soul of candor, looked at all of us and he said, well, gentlemen, I had a concept for this show and it doesn't work. Any suggestions? And that was a turning point for me, because up till then I had not really studied the books of the shows that I had done, Fiorello, The Body Beautiful, Tenderloin. I had to study them. I looked through them thinking, where do the songs go?
Right.
And that was my job. But I had nothing to contribute to that meeting at the Taft Hotel, and I thought, I will never let this happen again. God willing, I will get more shows, and I will really study the books and try and anticipate where the weak spots are, so I'll have suggestions as how to fix them. We worked very hard on Tenderloin, and it ran about 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
The way Bobby Griffith and Hal Prince budgeted their shows, they were so smart about it, that the show almost paid off its backers. I think it paid back about 85% or 90% because it was budgeted so intelligently.
That's almost a hit.
Almost a hit. But it didn't work, and the show is flawed, and rarely gets produced.
And it's funny that you can sort of say that and know that. I always wonder sometimes when you're out of town with a show or even writing it for Broadway, and you think maybe you don't know until the audience responds, but maybe you do have a gut feeling sometimes that you know it's just not there.
I didn't. I really didn't with those shows. And I don't think I've known in the future. But I have lived up to that promise I made myself. I have gotten involved with the books. And consequently, the shows that we did after that, She Loves Me, Fiddler on the Roof, The Apple Tree, The Rothschilds, the ones that Jerry Bach and I did, had good runs. They were, and they do get produced.
Well, sure. I mean, I will get back to Fiddler because I want to spend some extra time on that, of course. But
okay.
Did you see the She Loves Me, the Apple Tree a couple of years ago with Kristen Chenoweth?
Oh, absolutely. We saw it at the Encores at City Center, and in fact, we did a little work on it. And then we were hoping that Kristen would bring it to Broadway, and she did. She had a limited, she could only do it for about 15 weeks.
Right.
But she was superb. She's not only a magnificent voice, but and a good actress and an attractive woman, but she's a genuine clown, and there are very few of those around. So, and aside from all that, she is just a delightful human being. It was just a pleasure to work with her.
Oh, good.
So we, Jerry Bach and I, were involved in the rehearsal process, and we did make changes. We made trims. We changed a line here. We changed, added a line there, and we were very pleased with the result.
Now, that is so, I mean, when I think of that, and the fact that you guys, when I say you guys, I mean Bach, Harnick, Stein, this triumvirate, if you think about it,
You're a natural lyricist.
Thank you so much. but the fact that you're still alive, which is a wonderful thing, why haven't we heard that much from you all in the past 25 years?
Well, I've asked myself that same question, but usually it's because the shows that are offered to you take you in different directions. Joe Stein did ask me to do, he asked me and Jerry to do a show. He wanted to do a show about immigrants to America. But at the time that he had the book, I read it, and to me it looked like a film, not a musical, so I turned it down.
That was Rags?
Now, it turned out to be Rags. At that time, it had a different title. He kept working on it, and he got Charles Strauss and Steve Schwartz, who did a wonderful score for it. But it evolved and became a totally different show from the script that he had sent to me. We did get involved. Joe and I and Jerry got involved with another show about, 5 years ago, and we had... Without going into details, the producer was more or less incompetent, and it all fell apart.
Oh, come on. You've got to go into detail now.
I can't. I'll get sued.
If I look in the New York Post from that era, will I find his name?
Probably.
Yeah.
We hope that eventually we'll be able to go back to work on it.
Oh,
if I live long enough.
Well, can you mention the name of the show without that producer stuff? Or what?
Yes. The show was to have been called Miracles.
Oh, was that the Pocket Full of Miracles musical, or was that Jerry Herman?
No, this was an original of Joe's.
Oh, my gosh, okay.
Based on biblical themes.
But why can't you work on it without having that producer around? I mean, just work on it and try and get it to another...
Oh, we can, but I think all of us have had other obligations that we've had to fulfill.
Oh, sure.
And mine will occupy me for at least the next year, if not more. I'm hoping that I have a long life, long enough to come back to that and try and redo it.
So, Sheldon Harnick, what are you working on this year and next, or now?
Well, a couple of things. My current musical, which I'm trying to do myself because I'm having such fun with it, is an intimate musical, 9 or 10 people, based on the play by Molière called The Doctor in Spite of Himself.
Oh, okay.
I don't really have another title yet, but I'm close to finishing a first draft, and then I'll see what I have. So that's one project. Another project, when I turned 80 some years ago, I looked in my files to see if there was some show that really would bear reinvestigation. And I had done a show off-Broadway in 1961 with a book writer named Ira Wallach and a wonderful composer named David Baker, both of whom are no longer with us. We did a show off Broadway called Smiling the Boy Fell Dead, which is the last line of a poem by Browning. Anyway, I had four scripts. I read them all, and I find beautiful material in each one of them that wasn't in the final show. So I put together a new script, and I gave it to my wife and said, what do you think? And she said, this is charming. Well, we had a reading of it a year ago at a little theater in New Jersey, and it went extremely well. So that little theater has been trying to find another little theater to produce it with them jointly in a full production. And I just got a call from them last week. They did find that producer, so they're going to do it either late this year or early next year.
Mazel tov, yeah. Look, I am to that.
Thank you.
And by the way, when you say you showed it to your wife, I you know, people might be kind of curious that your wife, unless I'm mistaken, is an actress.
She is an actress, and wherever we go around, her stage name was Marjorie Gray. That was her real name, not her stage name. Marjorie Gray. And whenever we go around the country, when there are real theater buffs and they either recognize her or know that her name was Marjorie Gray, they say, oh, you did that wonderful version of Anything Goes that was off Broadway with Hal Linden. And on the recording, she sang two songs, The Heaven Hop, and I can't remember the other one. People know her for it. So she was wonderful. She, in fact, her career took her to a show called Tovaric, where she played one of Vivian Leigh's employers, the daughter of one of Vivian Leigh's employers, and she and Vivian became very close, very friendly.
Oh, wow.
So she had a career, but when we got married, she chose to give it up because she wanted a family, she wanted a home, she didn't want to have to be on the road, and what she's done instead, she's become, in my estimation, a superb painter, and that's what she does.
Oh, my gosh.
As well as being a wonderful mother and family person.
Cool. We're talking with Sheldon Harnick here in the neighborhood, the lyricist, and sometimes you do obviously a whole lot more, especially these days. You're doing the music, the lyrics, and the book.
And the adaptation.
And the adaptation.
For the Molière piece.
Pretty soon you'll be building the sets, I guess. Or maybe your wife will do that.
That's what she'll do. I have no visual talents at all.
But let's now get to, if you don't mind, the two big shows that you may most be known for. I don't think that's, you would
I
mind
think that's
that.
True. Oh, yeah. Sure, that's true.
Now, She Loves Me, which is a lovely, lovely show based on Little Shop Around the Corner. Whose idea was it to get involved in that, to adapt it into?
There was, I'm pretty sure he's no longer with us, but he was a producer named Larry Kasha. And he got the rights to it and contacted Jerry Bach and myself, and both of us knew the film and loved it. And he said that the book writer he wanted to use was a man named Joe Masteroff.
Oh.
And both Jerry and I had seen a play by Joe Masteroff. I can't remember the title. It didn't run very long, but it starred Julie Harris. We had seen it and really admired it. So we said, absolutely. And then we had a funny problem. The director we wanted was Gower Champion.
Hmm.
And Al Kasha went to Gower Champion, and Gower said, oh, I'd love to do it, but I can't. I have a prior commitment. So Jerry Bach and I said, let's take it to Hal Prince. Hal has been a wonderful producer for us, but we also know him as a very gifted director. We had seen something he had done. Well, he had come in to try and fix a show, A Family Affair, I think it was called, and he'd come very close to it. His work was wonderful. We had also seen, he had directed, I think, for the Theater Guild, a production of the straight play, The Matchmaker.
Hmm.
Anyway, we recommended him, and Al Kasha had a meeting with him, and he said, yes, this is a good idea. So we got Hal. I think the day after we had met with Hal and said yes, I don't think he had a contract yet, Kasha had a call from Gower Champion.
Oy.
Saying, I'm now available again. And we thought, we can't do this to Hal. We must go with him. And so we chose to go with him, and he came through for us. He was wonderful to work with. The show, for some reason, we've had many, many postmortems, the show didn't quite work. We got terrific reviews, but after about 6 months, we noticed that business was gradually falling off. It only ran between 9.5 and 10 months, which was heartbreaking for all of us.
Yeah.
And I think for the next year, there were no productions. And then there'd be a production here, a production there, And Jerry Bach and I and Joe Mastroff would get letters from the cast saying, we don't understand why this show didn't work on Broadway. Our audiences love it. And little by little, it became what they called a cult show. And then in 1993, I think it was, Scott Ellis directed a new production for the Roundabout Theater. And
right.
That catapulted the show into the mainstream because the reviews were such love letters that suddenly it was being done all over the country. So that was a long time coming, but it was wonderful.
Was that Sally Mays? Who was
she? Was in it, yeah.
And
originally it was Judy Kuhn.
Right.
And Judy got married and left the show to be with her husband. And we had Diane Fratton-Tony and Boyd Gaines, who was in it. He won a Tony for
yeah.
it. It was a lovely production.
It was pretty terrific. And then, well, that was 1963.
That was 1993.
The first production was
63 with right. Barbara Cook, yeah.
So if we go back there, then 1 year later, what I would consider, and perhaps I'm a little biased religiously, but for me, the greatest Broadway musical of all time.
I think you could say that.
Even
I'm a little biased, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's just something about Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's Jerry Robbins. And this is the reason I say that. When Jerry agreed to do the show, to direct and choreograph the show, he told us a story. He said, at the age of 6, he had been taken to Europe, to that area, Russia, Poland, I've forgotten exactly where, but that's where his forebears came from. So his folks took him there on a nostalgic trip, and he said it was very emotional, even for a kid of 6. And, of course, Robbins must have been a very sensitive child of 6. But he always remembered that visit. During World War II, when he realized that little villages, little shtetls like the one he had visited, were being wiped out, he was horrified. He thought the place that he visited was probably one of them. Well, along comes Joe Stein and Jerry Bach and myself, and we say, would you direct our show? And Jerry said to him, this was an opportunity to put that shtetl life, give that shtetl life an additional life of maybe 25 years by recreating it on the theatrical stage. So that, in my opinion, he was like a man obsessed. That was his mission, to put that life as vividly on stage as he could. And he worked like a demon.
Well, let me ask, the concept of the show ending with the Jews being forced out of Anatevka, was that a Robbins idea that tied it in, or was that already there from...
No, that's...
It wasn't Shalom Aleichem, or was it?
Oh, yeah, that's in Shalom Aleichem.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're forced out. Having Tevye go to America was our idea. In the original book, I think he goes to Palestine. But those shows were written long before the Holocaust, and I can't help but think that if Shalom Aleichem had lived long enough to experience the Holocaust, he too might have had his principal characters going off to America, as well as Palestine.
When you and Bach and Stein started collaborating on Fiddler, at what point did you realize it was special? It wasn't just a show or a good show or anything. When did you realize, oh, my God, this is going to...
I can tell you exactly when we realized, because
yeah.
At first we were scared to death. Harold Prince was our sole producer on... No, he wasn't, as a matter of fact. We had first taken it to a television producer. I'm blocking on his name right now, but he was very gifted. We loved his work, and he said he would do it. And then it turned out he was having emotional problems, and nothing was getting done. Jerome Robbins would take his time deciding who he wanted as a set designer or who he wanted as a lighting designer. And when he made his choice, then these people would call and say, hey, we have no contract.
Hmm.
Well, he got very worried, and he was justifiably worried because, as I say, the producer, maybe it's just as well, I can't remember his name, was having problems. So Jerry went to Hal Prince. And although Hal had been the first person we took it to, he didn't think it was right for him, but with Jerry Robbins involved, he said, yes, I will be your producer, and he was terrific. But he got us our out-of-town tryout in Detroit, and he said the managers of the Fisher Theater got him to accept a less than perfect deal. We had a subscription for 3.5 weeks, but they insisted that we stay in Detroit for 5 weeks. So we had a subscription for 3.5 weeks, and we thought if we get bad reviews, we could die there because nobody will buy tickets for the last week and a half. We have to be there. Then when we got to Detroit, we found something even more worrisome. Talk about reviews. There was a newspaper strike. So we didn't get any reviews.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we were scared to death. What's going to happen? Well, by the end of the 3.5 weeks, thank God, we were doing about 90% business. By the time we closed, we were selling out.
And this is Detroit, which
is
not exactly a hub of Judaism.
Yeah, this is Detroit. So we at that time, we didn't know we had anything special, but at least we thought, well, there's maybe it's Zero Mostel, whatever it is, there's something about the show that people like. Where we knew we had something special was when we went from Detroit to Washington, D.C. That was our next stop on the pre-Broadway tryout. And mind you, there'd been no reviews. And yet, when we got to Washington, we were astonished to see long lines at the box office before we opened, waiting to buy tickets. And we thought, my God, everybody in Detroit must have phoned their relatives and said, hey, you got to see this show. And we looked at each other and said, hey, there is something special about this show. Then the same thing happened when we got to New York. There were long lines at the box office. And I thought to myself, correctly as it turned out, this may be the only show I ever do where I don't have to worry about the critical response. And that was just as well because people think we got raves. We didn't. We got very mixed notices with, I think, one rave in the daily papers.
Huh.
And that was all.
Oh, I don't know. I recall there's a book of compiled reviews. I think Stephen Susskind put together a couple of them. And I think if you go through that, I wouldn't say you got panned. You might want to look those over again.
There was one, it's hard to call it a pan because it had some praiseworthy things in it, but it was Walter Kerr. His review ended by saying, too bad, near miss.
So, oh, well, too bad, right?
And the whoever was reviewing in the New York Times said, oh, what a show this could have been if they had Ernst Bloch do the music, or failing him, maybe Leonard Bernstein.
It
was damning us with faint praise. Or praising us with faint damns, whichever way it works.
I think the audiences have won. Well, also the critics have obviously warmed to it over the years as well.
Well, they have, all except for Ben Brantley. At our last revival, he should have recused himself because he made it very clear in his review that he didn't like the lyrics he called clumsy, the music he called sticky pudding, and I can't remember how he described Joe Stein's book. He doesn't like the show. He shouldn't have reviewed it.
Well, if he's clear that he doesn't like the show to begin with, and he's upfront about it, he has every right to review it. I mean, that's just his bias.
I suppose. I don't think so, but I suppose so.
I mean, and if you look at someone like John Simon, who has called it one of the great musicals of all, and he's mellowed over the years a bit, but even in that last revival, he was saying, "Oh yeah, this show is extraordinary."
Yeah, we got actually on the last revival, we had better reviews in the big magazines. Time, New Yorker, New York Magazine, so forth. Those were better than the dailies. But some of the dailies were pretty good. Hi, this is Sheldon Harnick, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on station WGBB.
Now, I don't quite want to leave Fiddler quite just yet, because I just want to go back into that milieu. I'm wondering, what was the biggest fight that you guys had, creatively, over the show? Was it with Jerome Robbins about the staging? Was there a song that somebody wanted in and somebody else said, no, the show's already too long and we can do this with a line of dialogue instead? What was like the argument?
We didn't have any really big fights. Jerome Robbins takes charge. We learned very early on that this was going to be his show because at one point we had many, many pre-production meetings. And Jerry wanted to do something which neither Joe Stein nor Jerry Bakken or I approved of. So one day we had our meeting with him and we said, Jerry, we want you to do the show the way Joe has written the scene. This is the way it must be. And Robbins thought for a minute and he said, okay, I'm sure your next director will be very happy to do that.
Well, yeah, he had a pull rank, you know.
Yeah, and with the idea that he might leave us, we collapsed. and wisely so, because he really knew what he was doing. So that's as close as we came to an argument. There were other moments. Oh, for instance, that we had a song in the first act for Huddle and Perchik was called "If I Were a Woman." If I Were a Woman, right? That started out with Perchik singing. It was a long song. It was about 4 minutes, and it worked. It was terrific. So we thought, you know, when we first saw it in front of an audience, we thought, good, that's not a problem. That song works. Well, while we were in Detroit, I think it was, Robbins came to us, and he said, I want to cut that song. We said, what are you talking about? The song works. He said, I know it works, but I think I can, but it's a long song, and it's a long show, and I think I can accomplish the same thing that the song accomplishes in 30 seconds of dance. And being Robbins, we thought, well, okay. And he said, look, if it doesn't work, we'll go back to the song. So we didn't argue. He tried it, and he did accomplish it. In 30 seconds, what he did was even better than the song. It showed so much. It was funny. It was touching. And it was exciting to watch the dancing. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
The biggest problem we had was his problem, and he's the one who solved it. In rehearsal, we saw what he had constructed. It was from the moment when Golda comes on stage to tell Tevye that Chava has run off with the Russian. She has married out of the faith. What Robbins had constructed was like an expressionistic 8 or 10 minute sequence where Tevye goes through the town looking for Chava, and he goes here and he goes there and he goes to talk to the priest. And as he's doing all this, the set is getting more and more distorted, almost like a German expressionistic movie. The lighting is becoming more dramatic, reds and greens. And I thought it was absolutely, when we saw it in dress rehearsal, I thought this is brilliant. When we tried it in front of an audience, they were stunned. They almost didn't respond. And we had a meeting afterwards, and Jerry said, anybody know what's wrong? We said, no. He said, maybe it's too long. So he began to trim it. And every time he took a little more out, the response began to grow.
Uh-huh.
And as he took more out, it grew more and more. Jerry Bock said, hey, maybe if he kills the whole thing, it'll stop the show. You know. And finally, what was left was just 3 minutes, which is still in the show, where the three daughters in dance, the three daughters meet their three suitors and go off, leaving Tevye.
Oh, yeah.
And what Robbins finally figured out, he said the whole show is naturalistic in style. And here in the second act, I introduced something that was expressionistic in style. It was so out of key, the audience didn't know what to make of it. And he said, and they were right, and I was wrong.
Well, the expressionism worked a little in the dream sequence, but the audience went with it there.
They went with it there because it was comic.
Yeah, that's true. Good point.
And also because it was a dream, and in a dream you can do just about anything.
What's black and white and red all over? Photocopies made at Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy kings of Broadway. Any job that you have, including black and white copies, and they've got a brand new color copier, great quality, good prices, wonderful family that has owned Hewlett Minuteman Press since the 1970s. So check them out, 516-569-5577, Hewlett Minuteman Press. They're the kings.
Hi, this is Sheldon Harnick, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on station WGBB.
All I can say is first of all, thank you so much for creating a show like Fiddler on the Roof. I mean,
It was Jerry Robbins, between Jerry and Hal Prince, they had Joe Stein and Jerry Bock and myself working at the peak of our abilities, I do believe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a question about that. Not that your abilities are impeded in any way 40 years later, 45 years later, and happy to have you still working. Have a couple more questions for Sheldon Harnick before we let you go.
Okay.
Because I want to ask about a couple of other shows. First of all, it may not have been a happy or successful experience, but you did work on a show with Richard Rodgers.
I did.
And?
What was happy about it was getting to know Rodgers and getting to work with him, because I fell in love with the man. Just before we went into rehearsal, we had to postpone because Rogers was suddenly taken to the hospital had a call from our producer, another songwriter, Richard Adler. He called and he said, Rogers has been taken to the hospital to have his larynx removed. He has cancer of the larynx. And we thought, oh, my God, that's the end of the show. But Rogers was such a gallant man, such a fighter. As soon as the operation was over, he went to a special school to learn laryngeal speech. He learned how to speak laryngeally, which is not easy, and then we went back into rehearsal. And I mean, we didn't go back into rehearsal, we went into rehearsal. And throughout, I began to appreciate his gallantry and his sense of humor. I thought he was just wonderful. Unfortunately, he had had a stroke, and I learned later through a doctor that the stroke impaired his ability to think abstractly, so that he could not write music first. You know, part of his legend was that with Larry Hart, all the music came first. When he worked with Hammerstein, Hammerstein constructed the lyrics first, and then Rogers would write the music. But with me, he could not literally write music first, so every lyric had to come first, and that was difficult. The difficulty in the show...
But, by the way, the show is called Rex.
It's called Rex.
Yeah.
The difficulty, and there were a couple of difficulties. One was simply our leading man, Nickel Williamson, who is, he can be trouble in the show. He's wonderful. He's a brilliant actor, and it turns out he's a terrific musician. But he came to feel that he wasn't right for the show, and he really was so unhappy that it made a lot of problems. We also, afterwards, let me tell the story this way.
Sure.
25 years after the show opened and closed all too quickly, Sherman Yellen and I had a call from James Morgan, who runs the York Theater. And he wanted to do the show there in concert as one of those five performance musicals and Mufti's shows.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherman and I said, why do we want to do that? We made so many mistakes. Let's not see it up on its feet again. And then Sherman said, hey, ask him if he will allow us to reinvestigate the show and maybe do it a year from now. And Morgan said, take your time. Whenever you're ready, I'll do it. Well, we reinvestigated the show, and after 25 years, we were able to spot the mistakes very easily. We redid the show. We had our five performances, and they were received very enthusiastically. The following year, we had a full production at Findlay University in Ohio, where, again, it was received enthusiastically. And then last summer, a little theater in Chicago called Theater Building Chicago used it in a concert version as their benefit. They did two performances of it, and it was the best yet. Sherman and I were there. We made some more changes. And after the show, people from the audience came up, and instead of saying, hey, I enjoyed it, they said, you know something? It's wonderful.
Oh.
So Rodgers and Hammerstein, which handles it, is now prepared for the first time to start licensing it.
Cool.
Who
knows?
We really recouped.
That's wonderful. I don't know the show, but as I said, all those shows from back then with such talented people, even now, shows that have tremendously talented people and are actually pretty good but just may not click. You bring them back 20, 25, 30 years later, and then you're like, hey, these are still terrific.
Right. I saw a beautiful example of that in this last tribute to Joe Stein at the York Theater. One of the shows they did was Enter Laughing.
Well, So Long 124th Street was, or 100, what was it, So Long 100?
It was So Long 124th Street, which had a very short run on Broadway. It was Bobby Morse, and it was a big flop. Well, he changed the name. He did a little rewriting, but not much. But again, they had the right cast and the right director, and it was wonderful. It was so good, in fact, that the York hopes to be able to produce it as one of their full-scale productions, not a concert production.
Oh,
it was wonderful.
And, again, before I let you go, we talked about your working with Richard Rogers, and you had obviously wonderful things to say. You did two different shows with Michel Legrand, and I'm wondering about your relationship working with him.
He's wonderful to work with. He is so gifted. What I did learn was that it was better for him to let him write the music first. I think the reason is that although he speaks wonderful English and he's a very intelligent, well-read guy, because English is still a second language for him, if I gave him a lyric first, I could not depend on the fact that he would understand all the nuances of English so that the lyric might be set in an odd way. So I learned that it was wiser to let him write music first and then do the lyrics to the music, and then the accents would all be in the right places.
Huh.
But we did a Christmas carol together, and every Christmas we have, I don't know, we have a number of performances. It's a seasonal show, but that gets done. I translated The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and that gets the occasional performance, too.
Cool. What do you think of the, quote-unquote, the new guard of Broadway composers and lyricists, people like William Finn or Adam Gettle or David Yazbek? Are they too much success too soon, or are they really great?
I think Adam Gettle is great, and I don't use that word often, but what he accomplished in Light in the Piazza, I think, was extraordinary. It's such a moving, beautiful score. It's not a traditional theater score, and there are people who would have to hear the score a couple times before they would accept it as a musical comedy. But it's a wonderful, wonderful score. Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty are very gifted. From Ragtime on, their shows are always intelligent, always worth seeing. David Yazbek, I have to confess, I didn't care for his second show, but the first one, I thought his score was wonderful. The
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, or...
No, that was the second one.
Oh, right. Well,
the one about the men who take off their clothes.
Full Monty.
Yes, the Full Monty. I thought that was wonderful. I had occasion the other day to listen to Spring Awakening, and I think the music to that is simply beautiful. The lyrics are done in a kind of style that I'm not really that familiar with, and they both know the rock literature inside and out, and I think that's affected the lyrics so that I'm not as comfortable with them, but the music is really beautiful.
What would you say, then, if you had to pick a couple of musicals of all time that weren't yours, what would they be, the greatest musicals?
Oh, Chorus Line, I think, is surely one. I saw the production of it not too long ago, and I think that is... The construction of that show is absolutely astonishing. It's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I think both The King and I and Carousel are both extraordinary shows, and Guys and Dolls. And there are others, but those come to mind immediately.
Is it for all the usual obvious reasons, or do you have a special take or slant on some of these?
No, I think they're somehow the writers who were doing the shows got inspired, so that both the book, the lyrics, and the scores for those shows are all top-notch, and they all mesh in an incredible way. I think inspiration is behind it, because the same writers have done other shows which had craft, which had intelligence, and were good, but were maybe not inspired. But those shows are inspired.
And, speaking of inspiration and stuff, the one thing that I want to broach rather delicately is that you lost your brother about a year ago.
Yes, February will be a year anniversary, and what Jay was doing with his children's theater was just wonderful. We were so proud of him, so proud of what he accomplished. When he and his partner, Charlie Hull, who handled the business side of things, when they left TheaterWorks USA, when they retired, they made sure they got extremely capable people to follow them, and it's been a joy to me to read the reviews, the successive reviews of new shows that the new people have put on, so that the organization that Jay and Charlie founded is still going strong.
That's great. And did you ever work with him on a show?
I never was able to. I was always busy doing something else.
Do you regret that?
I do regret it, yeah. But what was very moving was that when he died, I never had so many letters from so many people who had worked with Jay. And so many of them said, he gave me my first job. You know, people like Audra McDonald, or people like Michael Mayer, who directed Spring Awakening, or the conductor who, our second conductor on the recent revival of the Apple Tree. They all said he was wonderful to work with, his humor, his patience, his talent. It was very moving to me to read those letters.
Wow. And, all I can say is that you certainly have inspired a lot of people with your lyrics and with the shows that you have done, and I just hope that continues. I hope they do.
Me too.
And that they bring back shows like Rex and some other things that may not have worked the first time or may not have clicked the first time, as well as the wonderful Chestnuts and Perennials that you've done and the new shows that you're working on now.
Thank you so very much.
So, Sheldon Harnick, thank you for being in the neighborhood.
You're welcome, and it was wonderful to talk to you.